I'm determined to beat Cliff's clock tonight, so we're going to go right into it, and I'm not going to digress. When discussing the history of World War II, most of us have read books or listened to tapes questioning the official Allied and Israeli versions of that stupendous 20th century conflict. Many of us doubt the sacred 6 million casualty figure given for the number of Jewish deaths in the war. We doubt the millions of people having been exterminated in Auschwitz gas chambers, and we doubt much of the liturgy of the gas chamber tales, the wild miracle stories which are accepted and repeated unquestioningly by the establishment media. The issue is one of doubt, by the way. We're not trying to persuade people to believe something, but rather to doubt something. They are the blind believers. We are the liberated skeptics. The distinction is important. It is not incumbent on us to believe miracle stories of the Jewish religion. And this is what many of these wildly exaggerated tales of the 6 million are. They are theology disguised as historiography. Let me give you a few examples. A Zionist named Morris Hubert claims to have been sent to Buchenwald. He says, and I quote, "In the camp there was a cage with a bear and an eagle. Every day they would throw a Jew in there. The bear would tear him apart, and the eagle would pick his bones." Or how about the one told by Berta Jauzewicz of Miami? She says that she, quote, "was moved to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. One day she stole some turnips. She was caught by the Germans and forced to lick the kitchen floor clean with her tongue." You believe that? Rabbi Dr. Moshe Weiss informs us, quote, "Nazis transported from the Auschwitz camp to Germany 7 trainloads of women's hair, from which the Germans produced soft mattresses for the German population." You've heard of Sealy Posturepedic? This was Sheeny Posturepedic. Apparently, the Nazis also ran a travel agency for Jews. According to testimony of Meyer Hirsch, he was sent by the Nazis to 9 different death camps. And yet, by a miracle, none of these camps proved deadly to him. The Germans must have been running a travel agency. 9 different death camps. It makes you wonder what sort of death camps they were when this fellow survived 9 of them. Certainly, it is not incumbent on anybody to believe such nonsensical stories. And yet, doubting or laughing at these Jewish fables has become a virtual hate crime. Today, I'm going to discuss with you the brick wall that many of us are running into when we share our doubts about these stories with others. We should be gaining a lot more ground than we have, and I want to take you through a careful and sustained analysis of why we've been stymied, and then give you the ammunition that you need to prevail against the opponents of truth in this realm. These doubts of ours on this subject have run into something of a brick wall when it comes to getting our friends, neighbors, and relatives to doubt with us. They have accepted the new state religion of the Holocaust. They worship at its synagogue disguised as a museum in Washington, D.C. They are in the audience at its liturgical pageants when Schindler's List and other solemn rites are screened without commercial interruption before a congregation of millions. They venerate the miraculous relics of the saints and martyrs of this cult, and they are resisting our revisionist doubts. But if we are right and they are badly bamboozled and deceived, how is it that we are not having greater success in sharing our skepticism with others? We can win against the gas chamber propagandists, against the cult of the holy hoax, against the martyrology of the Kabbalistic 6 million. But to do so, we must become detectives, sleuths, if you will, but of a very specialized sort. We must become detectives of language, because by doing so, we will get to the root of the hoax that oppresses us. In the beginning was the Word. And the preeminent observer of the manipulation of words was the great English writer George Orwell. Orwell was that rare species, an honest leftist. He had worked as a policeman in Burma and as a propagandist for BBC Radio in London. And he combined those two traits to become the greatest authority in our time on how thought cops use language to constrict independent thinking. Before I apply Orwell's insights to the case at hand, a little background is in order. in 1977, a former apologist for the Israeli terrorist group, the Irgun, one Eli Wiesel, was facing a terrible dilemma. The hysteria of World War II propaganda, the shrill hatred for the Germans, the racist claims of their collective guilt, their atrocity mongering about war crimes, was in 1977 starting to fade. It was being replaced by that most normal of human sentiments, the desire to bury the hatchet, to forgive, to get on with life, and a new birth of reconciliation. This healthy process among human beings, this healing between the nations of Europe and America, was regarded by the Zionist ideologue Eli Wiesel as nothing short of a disaster. But he was fighting an upstream battle, for it has been the process after every war for the lies which were told to the troops and to the population at home in order to extract the full measure of their devotion and sacrifice during the war to be revealed after hostilities have ended as having been little more than the product of the fevered imaginations of the clerks and bureaucrats in the war offices and defense departments of the government. A few decades after the conclusion of the American War Between the States, veterans North and South gathered at reunions and saluted each other's bravery. The same process was beginning to unfold between the U.S. and the Germans in the 1960s and 70s. German rocket scientists had placed American astronauts on the moon. John F. Kennedy had gone to Berlin, Ich bin ein Berliner, and saluted the West Germans as vital partners in the struggle against communism. German engineering and German intellectual achievement in academics, philosophy, and music were again widely applauded. The thrifty, industrious German people were once again admired in Europe and America. The 6 million story, the so-called genocide, was joining a host of other horrors in this most bloody and deadly of all centuries as an equivalent misdeed, one among many. A special racist perfidy attached to the German people was fast fading. Why would Eli Wiesel and his Israeli partners in persuasion oppose so normal and natural a process? Because Wiesel was a far-sighted Zionist who was able to discern the fact that if the fevered war-era propaganda which Jewish and allied assets in the media had managed to stoke long past 1945 were allowed to flicker and die out in the 1970s, the Israelis would no longer be able to extort the capital that funded their dispossession of the Palestinians, or obtain the immunities and special privileges which have transformed them from a scorned people to the veritable master race of the West. Wiesel knew, down to the depths of his marrow, that if people were to take the 6 million tale off its pedestal and place it on par with the 10 million Lenin and Trotsky killed, the 30 million Stalin slaughtered, and the 50 million Mao Zedong butchered, Jewish power in America and the reign of God's chosen real estate dealers in the Middle East would soon be severely diminished. Now, you will notice that throughout my brief discussion of this subject, I have seldom used the word Holocaust to describe the Jewish experience in World War II. This is due to the fact that before Eli Wiesel introduced his momentous solution to the fading of World War II propaganda in the 1970s, the word Holocaust was not associated with the Jews. So effective has Wiesel been since 1977 that we have forgotten that prior to 1977, the word Holocaust and its ancillary adjectives was primarily applied by our parents and grandparents to the 20th century as a whole. Or more specifically, to the experience of German civilians in Dresden and other firebombed cities in Germany. While there are hundreds of examples of this, for purposes of brevity, I will cite two. I am holding in my hand a paperback copy of British writer Anthony Powell's novel, The Kindly Ones, from his great tetralogy, A Dance to the Music of Time. The edition I am holding was published in the United States in 1962 by Berkeley Medallion Books of New York City, which, to the best of my knowledge, is not a Nazi or right-wing publishing house. It's a mainstream company. If we flip the book over and read the publisher's squib on the back side, it speaks of the entrance of the West after the start of World War I into what it calls, and I quote, the Holocaustal Age. the age of the Holocaust. In other words, the editors at Berkeley Medallion, in introducing Powell's famous novel to American readers, were alluding to the fact that our 20th century itself, which has seen two world wars and the rise of totalitarian dictatorships which liquidated millions of lives, was itself as a whole the Holocaust century. That's what it says in the back of this book. The very time we are living in has been a Holocaust for all who lived through it, not just the Jews. The perception of the intellectual elite of the 1960s, and you can't get more elite than an Anthony Powell novel, associated the experience of Holocaust with the entire historical record of this bloody 20th century, with the Somme, with Verdun, with all the dictatorships, the tyrants, the atomic bombs, and so forth. And this is precisely correct and strictly rational historical understanding. Hundreds of millions of people have died since the beginning of World War I in this bloodiest of all centuries due to new deadly modern armaments and the new deadly modern ideologies which have accompanied them. And how could anyone deny that such an enormity constituted a Holocaust for all the victims and all their survivors? Hence, it was a widely understood fact in the 1960s and the 1970s that the 20th century itself was the age of Holocaust for everyone involved, not just one self-chosen race or nation of people. And in the 1960s and early 70s, people were becoming aware of that fact. Now, let's take our nation's pulse at the opposite spectrum of the popular culture of the 60s and 70s. We've just peeked at highbrow culture. Let's look at American juvenilia in the form of the ubiquitous comic book. Here I am holding a comic book that was nearly universal throughout my childhood, and one to which I was very much devoted as an adolescent. It was the Sergeant Fury line of comics from the Marvel Publishing Company. Again, not a company that is neo-Nazi or right-wing or anything similar. This comic book was published in 1973. I'll describe the cover of the comic book to you. The lurid color cover is aflame with red ink. Sergeant Fury, the American combat infantryman, and his fellow soldiers seem to be entering a city that has become an inferno. And on the cover, you will see the headline for this comic book, down towards the bottom, read by millions of children and adults for that matter, and the headline reads, "Caught in the Holocaust that was Dresden." How about that? The common perception in the early 1970s, and you can't get more common than a Marvel comic book, associated the experience of a Holocaust with what the German people went through when their cities were firebombed by the Allied air forces. Once again, this is the precisely correct and strictly rational historical understanding. At least 100,000 women, children, elderly, and helpless refugees fleeing the Red Army were burned to a crisp on the deliberate orders of Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. Now, since the word Holocaust literally denotes death by fire, how could anyone deny that Dresden was a Holocaust? And in the early 1960s and early 70s, people didn't deny it. And Elie Wiesel, a master of the manipulation of words, looked on this rapidly emerging equanimity in the perceptions of the people of the West and panicked. He knew and his brethren knew they would have to copyright the phrase Holocaust to trademark and harness it as the exclusive domain of only one nation of people. And so, in 1977, Wiesel began, by the power and authority vested in him by the establishment media and academia, to refer only to the period 1933 to 1945 as a Holocaust, and only to the experience of the Jewish people in that period as having undergone a Holocaust. And Wiesel was astonishingly successful. His monopoly of that word Holocaust has been repeated and parroted and validated to such an extent that today, in 1997, just 20 years removed from Wiesel's original gambit, and people cannot think in terms independent of Wiesel's original intention. If you say Holocaust today, people don't think of Dresden, Germany. They think of the Jews and Auschwitz. So, as word sleuths, ourselves, as detectives, investigating this process so as to debunk it and free our people from it, What shall be our attitude toward the use of Mr. Wiesel's application of the word Holocaust to our own skepticism and arguments? Believe it or not, most revisionists, like most of the rest of humanity in the West, have followed the herd and accepted Wiesel's interpretation. They argue on his grounds, using his terms, and that is why we have been obstructed in our campaign against World War II-era propaganda. You don't fight a battle on the enemy's terms. You force the enemy to fight on your terms. Elie Wiesel and his influential Jewish cohorts influenced the society around them to believe their ideas, to use their language, thus wholly or partially reconfiguring our own perception of reality. Let's turn to George Orwell's book, 1984, for a better understanding of this con game that we've been suckered into playing. Obtain a copy of Orwell's book, 1984. You can get it almost any new or used bookshop for a few dollars. And turn to the appendix at the back of the book. The appendix to Orwell's book, 1984, is entitled The Principles of New Speak. Orwell had studied Stalinist and communist propaganda techniques closely, especially as they applied to journalism and language. And he wrote his book, 1984, to warn humanity of how he thought these principles would be applied to manipulate our thought processes in the future. He called it new speak because these futuristic tyrants need to impose a new language upon us in order to change us, but more importantly, to make independent thinking impossible. Because when government or media tinker with language, they are tampering with the very structure and foundation of how we see the world. We cannot see the world clearly and truly if the words we are using are intrinsically corrupted. Take, for example, the word gay. Now, that used to be just a wonderful word, denoting the most carefree type of innocence embodied in the phrase, "We had a gay old time." But what happened to that sweet word? It was corrupted by totalitarian tyrants, neo-Bolsheviks, really, because Orwell was primarily thinking of the Bolshevik system when he wrote 1984, and we have plenty of neo-Bolsheviks around today. And neo-Bolsheviks are always coercive utopians. They're going to build heaven on earth by force, whether the recipients of their paradise like it or not, because the neo-Bolshevik intelligentsia know better than we do what is good for us. In our democratic paradise, a 16-year-old girl can obtain an abortion, but it's illegal for her to smoke a cigarette. A 13-year-old boy can obtain condoms from his teacher, but it's against the law for him to ride his bicycle without wearing a helmet. History teaches us, from the example of Rabelais' Abbey of Thelema, all the way up to the French Revolution of Danton and Robespierre, to the civil wrongs revolution of Earl Warren, Martin Lucifer King, and Lyndon B. Johnson, that the fastest path to hell on earth is when the architects of coercive utopianism achieve state power. As these neo-Bolsheviks become increasingly sophisticated, they expand the domain of their control from the purely physical to the psychological and intellectual. It wasn't enough for them to imprison the body, they also need to imprison the mind. So when we examine the record of the Black Socialist Revolution in the U.S., which destroyed thriving black businesses by replacing a black entrepreneurial ethic with a poverty pimp mentality, and which stole from all of us the right to privacy and the rights of employers and landlords to decide who we will employ or allow on our property, it isn't called the Black Socialist Revolution, is it? It's called the Civil Rights Movement. Even though the rights of the majority were curtailed and not enhanced. This is what Orwell termed newspeak. When we look at the legitimacy accorded to male homosexuals who came out of the closet where they should have stayed and began to proclaim that their use of the sewers of the human body for sexual intercourse was a liberating and indeed superior form of sex, when they proclaimed this insanity, this phenomenon was not called the Sodomite Sewer Society, but the Gay Rights Movement. They have taken a beautiful word, formerly used as a term for innocence and endearment, and made it into a synonym for filth, disease, and death. So now filth, disease, and death become gay. I don't know about you, but I never use the word gay to describe a homosexual. Now, the suffering of the Jews in World War II, which was comparable to the suffering of many other nations in that horrible conflict, is no longer known by the precise allusion to the allegation at hand. It is no longer mainly termed the genocide or the 6 million, but it is now called the Holocaust. And no other Holocaust experience of any other nation can be any longer so called without drawing down the wrath of the rabbinical thought cops. This is newspeak in its essence. Let's see what Orwell has to say about it in his appendix to the book 1984. Quote, "The purpose of newspeak was not only to provide a medium of expression for the worldview and mental habits proper to the devotees, but to make all other modes of thought impossible. When newspeak has been adapted once and for all, and old speak forgotten, a heretical thought should be literally unthinkable." Newspeak was designed not to extend, but to diminish thought. End quote. In other words, as Orwell says, there are words which have been deliberately constructed or altered for political purposes, and those who refuse to use the newspeak and cling to the old language are stigmatized and hounded as thought criminals, as anti-Semites, as neo-Nazis, and so forth. Now let's take and apply this situation to the skepticism about World War II gassings. In 1977, Elie Wiesel began to apply, through pressure and infiltration, his newspeak on the world. In 1978, the docudrama television series Holocaust premiered on national TV for several evenings, introducing and popularizing the word Holocaust as the proper newspeak word that all right-thinking people were supposed to use exclusively from henceforward to describe what supposedly happened to Jews during World War II. The gas chamber cultists began to use this word Holocaust as the nearly exclusive term of description for the sufferings of the Jews, real and imagined, during World War II. And eventually, our side adopted their slogan and incorporated it as our own. And that is why, in part, our cause is not advancing as it should, because we are using the very Orwellian newspeak of the enemy. And so long as we do, no matter how many facts we marshal, or how much engineering, science, and demographics we refer to, we are not able to penetrate as many minds as we should, because we are attaching our heretical thoughts about World War II to the very newspeak intended to make independent thoughts about the history of World War II impossible. Here's what Orwell says happened in such a scenario. Quote, "In newspeak, it was seldom possible to follow a heretical thought further than the perception that it was heretical." Do you catch that? "In newspeak, it was seldom possible to follow a heretical thought further than the perception that it was heretical." In other words, once we employ the Jewish newspeak word Holocaust as part of our argument about what really happened to the Jews in World War II, people are not going to be able to follow us, because all they're going to be able to think at the time is that we're heretics, deniers. In newspeak, quoting now again from Orwell, "it was seldom possible to follow a heretical thought further than the perception that it was heretical." Let's say I'm in a discussion with a friend about what happened in World War II. So we've got a skeptic and a true believer. Come here, Brenda. And they're talking to one another. And I'm going to be the skeptic and Brenda's going to be the true believer. I don't see how you can believe everything that the media says about the Holocaust.
You mean you don't believe the Holocaust happened?
I think the Holocaust is a hoax.
Oh, come on. You must be crazy. There's millions of pictures, film footage, eyewitnesses, survivors.
Yes, and a lot of that is fake.
Think the Holocaust didn't happen? It's like saying the Civil War didn't happen. You must be nuts. Don't talk to me anymore. Goodbye.
That conversation is... Don't go too far, Brenda. That conversation is very typical of many of the exchanges that we experience with our friends and neighbors, isn't it? When we try to initiate discussion on this subject, and it reflects our fundamental intellectual indolence. We are failing to take charge of the terms of the debate. We are using the language of our opponents, language that was devised from its inception to limit people's ability to think, and this is just what happened in the preceding exchange. The believer couldn't even conceive of what the skeptic was talking about. Now, let's see what happens when we turn the tables and we command the language and we establish the terms of discourse. Skeptic, I don't see how you can believe everything the system says about the gas chambers.
You mean the gas chambers that killed the Jews, man? You deny the Holocaust?
No, I don't deny the Holocaust. I don't deny that 600,000 German civilians were deliberately burned to death by Allied firebombs in most of the major cities of Germany. I don't deny that it was a lot safer to be in Auschwitz than it was in any major German city during World War II. And I don't deny that World War II as a whole was a Holocaust for everyone involved, not just the Jews. 55 million people died in World War II.
Well, I don't believe in that stuff about Dresden.
Now look at who's the Holocaust denier.
Are you trying to say that people other than Jews suffered a Holocaust?
The facts of history are that millions of people in this century alone suffered a Holocaust, and some of them, Russian Christians and Palestinians, suffered it at the hands of the Jews.
So what? That doesn't make that what Hitler did any better.
I didn't say it did. I'm only saying that I don't believe everything I'm told by the media. I doubt that 6 million Jews were killed. I doubt the idea they were gassed in Auschwitz.
Then you're saying the Jewish Holocaust didn't happen?
Those are your words, not mine. I believe that some Jews, along with the Allied governments, have wildly exaggerated the stories of Jewish suffering. Many of the stories we've been told about World War II have been wildly exaggerated.
You think that gives you the right to doubt some of the stories?
Exactly. I have the right to doubt. We don't have a state religion in America. I can't be forced to believe something which my conscience tells me has not been proven scientifically to my satisfaction. I've done a fair amount of independent study on the subject, and what I've read doesn't square with the picture presented in the media. If we have the right to doubt the virgin birth and the divinity of Jesus Christ, why don't we have the right to doubt the existence of homicidal gas chambers in Auschwitz?
Hey, you know, I never thought of that. Do you have any books you can loan me about this?
You're welcome to my library. Thank you, Brian. Thank you. Note well here, the terms that I have used all predate 1977. When I refer to the era of the 1940s and the points of the debate, I make specific references to the specific issues at hand. I call the period in question World War II. I refer to the notion of the 6 million and the story of homicidal gassings in Auschwitz. I say homicidal gassings because there were gassing facilities in Auschwitz as a hygienic prophylactic against the typhus contagion. The Germans gassed the bedding and clothes of the Auschwitz laborers in order to keep them alive and not to kill them. You will note that when I employ the term Holocaust, I apply it to the sufferings of the Germans, the victims of the Soviets, and the victims of the Israelis. I do not claim that Jews did not suffer. I do not say they were not murdered or persecuted. Those things happened. I say that the stories about the 6 million have been unconscionably exaggerated for financial and political gain, and that many other nations of people have suffered a Holocaust, including the people of Russia and Palestine, who have been victims of Jewish communists and Jewish Zionists. My friends, if you argue as I have done, and you're consistent, if you discipline yourself to discourse with precision and awareness of language manipulation, you'll win your arguments. You'll begin to get others to doubt, and you'll begin to advance the cause of World War II revisionism like never before. More than that, you'll be contributing to the cause of truth and man's eternal struggle to think for himself, free and independent of the dictators and the mind controllers and their crippled and contorted Holocaust newspeak. The facts are on our side. The incredibly shrinking 6 million story is in plenty of trouble. The sacred Auschwitz death toll has fallen dramatically over the years. L'Express, the Time magazine of France, in its January 26, 1995 cover story. This is the Time magazine of France, entitled Les Mémoires du Mal, or The Bad Memory, stated that the homicidal gas chambers in Auschwitz were constructed by the Soviets after the war. This is admitted by the Auschwitz authorities themselves. The sacred Auschwitz death toll has fallen dramatically over the years. The French War Crimes Research Office says that 8 million people died in Auschwitz. According to the New York Times of France, the newspaper Le Monde, 5 million people died in Auschwitz. The figure engraved on the plaques at Auschwitz itself up until 1990 said 4 million died in Auschwitz. According to the so-called confessions of Commandant Rudolf Huss, 3 million died in Auschwitz. We keep going down. No, says Professor Yehuda Bauer of Hebrew University, only 1.6 million died in Auschwitz. But according to Professor Raoul Hilberg, 1.25 million died in Auschwitz. Establishment historian Gerald Reitlinger, in his book The Final Solution, says 850,000 people died in Auschwitz. And what are historians coming to find is the actual number of deaths in Auschwitz for all inmates, Catholics, Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses, from typhus, malnutrition, overwork, and execution by firing squad or hanging. 75,000 people actually died in Auschwitz, according to the archives from the camp itself, seized by the Russians and in their possession today. This huge, massive, supposedly unprecedented, veritable extermination factory, and we find that 75,000 people died in Auschwitz over the entire course of the years it operated. Now, that's still a horrible figure, and I mourn those people. But 75,000 German women and children died in one night in Dresden. Now, you tell me, which was the Holocaust? Thank you.
This tape is copyright 1997 by Michael A. Hoffman II. For a complete catalog of Mr. Hoffman's books, tapes, and magazines, send $2 to Independent History, Box 849, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816. Or visit our news bureau and archives online at www.hoffman-info.com.